The following is a Media for Movie Club production. Welcome back to the Media for Movie Club podcast. I am John Kissel, and with me tonight is no one. It's just me tonight. And I'm going to talk about the last three movies that we watched at the Media for Movie Club. Dolomite Is My Name, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and Private Life. I have a lot of thoughts on all these movies, and I'm going to talk to myself about them. What we usually do here at the Media Movie Club, a group of friends who just really want to talk about movies, want to talk about TV, and our regular format is that we select three movies every month, we write a review of them on our website, mediacommovie.club, and then we get together, normally, tonight we're not, to discuss those three movies for a podcast episode, and we do various extraneous things as well. We got Watchmen, a Watchmen series going right now, there should be another episode of that coming out soon. But in the meantime, let's talk about these movies. Our first movie is Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. This is English director Edgar Wright making a video game homage, making a kind of Arrested Development, kind of young adult movie. A lot of stuff going on in the background, a lot of graphics, a lot of video game noises, a lot of homages to sitcoms. But it's an adaptation of a comic by Brian Lee O'Malley titled The Same, I think, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. I don't know anything about that comic, but the movie itself, ADD would be a way to describe it. It's all over the place. It keeps the eyes busy and the ears busy as much as possible. People of a certain age really love Edgar Wright. I would say probably around my age, between like 25 and 40. Like if you saw Shaun of the Dead when you were in college or something, it might very well have blown your mind that a movie could be like this, could be so meta, could be so funny, could be occasionally heartfelt despite all of its various laughs. And Scott Pilgrim, I mean, I wouldn't call it heartfelt by any means, but it certainly has those rapid-fire jokes, those rapid-fire references, cultural references. It's very much living in the world that Edgar Wright movies very often have. Edgar Wright, he also made, in addition to Shaun of the Dead, he also made Hot Fuzz. He made The World's End, which form the Cornetto trilogy, as he termed it. And he also recently made Baby Driver, or his most recent movie is Baby Driver. But Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, this was, I remember in 2010 when this came out, there was a lot of hype around it. There was a big Comic-Con exhibit dedicated to it. At a certain point, Edgar Wright showed up and was like, hey, wouldn't everyone like to watch this movie? And a bunch of people got led to a nearby movie theater, and they all sat down and watched Scott Pilgrim, and everyone was like, oh my gosh, they loved it. This is going to be a huge smash hit. And it was not. It came out at the end of the summer, and I wouldn't necessarily say it was a failure, but it certainly underperformed, and it kind of broke the Comic-Con marketing. I think from that point, movie executives, directors kind of started to shy away from the idea that they could sell a movie at Comic-Con. Like this nerd group, this people of a certain age who are big Edgar Wright fans, they might very well be those diehard enthusiasts, but that doesn't necessarily translate to a wider audience because his tastes are so specific. Like this movie is paying homage to The Legend of Zelda, paying homage to handheld gaming and alternative rock and Seinfeld, strangely enough, in one scene. And whether or not any of that works for the viewer, I think depends on, like I said, their age and also their tolerance for just constant references and so on and so on and so on. But if you strip all that out, the movie, Scott Pilgrim, played by Michael Cera, who, you know, of course, was on Arrested Development, but he's another one of these Arrested Development protagonists who is... He's 22, I believe, in the movie, but he very much acts still as a teenager. He can't really take care of himself. He's just crashing on couches and in his good friend's apartment, who can barely tolerate him. He doesn't really take care of himself or anything around the apartment. He has a very nonchalant, blasé, laissez-faire attitude towards women, although he does seem to be fairly talented at picking up the ladies. It's all very... I referred to him as Jerry from Rick and Morty in my review. Just a beta male all the way down, who is going to get women to be around him by making them feel sorry for him. He's kind of a very pathetic creature. And if he's not trying to attract women to him through being pathetic. He's doing it by going after women that are too young for him by a wide margin. He's doing so by wowing them with his obscure pop culture knowledge, with his band Sex Bomb, and he just doesn't have a lot going for him. I feel like Scott Pilgrim would have turned into like a big Gamergate guy if this movie stretched a few years into the future. He would have been very upset that his treasured video games were being infected by feminist criticism and the idea that more women want to play these and maybe don't necessarily want to just be a plumber rescuing a princess every time. So that might have been a darker sequel, but this movie didn't get a sequel. This movie, not a success. In 2010, the Arrested Development protagonist kind of had run its thread out. We were past the time of Knocked Up and Forgetting Sarah Marshall was the year previous. Superbad, not so much, but it's very much in that same vein. 40-Year-Old Virgin, Judd Apatow comedies, his whole stable of writers, creators, just people that are stuck in adult bodies and still very much want to live as adolescents. Scott Pilgrim is a different kind of that type, but he's very much of that type, and that is also going to determine how far you get with this movie. Like, I first saw this in theaters in 2010, and in the intervening 9 years, I've just become less tolerant of that type. Whether or not he is going to start taking care of himself after this movie, after the events of this movie, kind of an open question, and I would honestly lean towards no. He finds the power of self-respect in the end, but who knows what that translates into. There are big parts of Scott Pilgrim that I find tiresome and cutesy and over the top and way too much. That's not to say there isn't a lot to just like capital L love in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Michael Cera, I think, gives a phenomenal physical performance. The way that he plays the bass for his band Sex Bomb, just the way he throws his whole body into it and he's like curling around his bass guitar, that is eminently rewatchable. Just that one, like, you know, that's like a perfect GIF before GIFs were all over the place. Edgar Wright and Cera both, they just knew what they were doing in creating that very small background action, but it communicates a lot of passion on Scott's part for this one tiny corner of his world that he just doesn't really bring to anything else. I love everything that Brendan Routh is doing as one of the evil exes that Scott has to fight over the course of the movie. Evil exes of Ramona Flowers, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. He is the third one. He is a bass player for a much more famous band. He's much more talented than Scott Pilgrim. He's a vegan who has vegan powers. And the movie both elevates the absurdity of the idea of something like vegan powers. Lots of a lot of telekinesis. And Routh himself has a lot of fun, both being deeply stupid, but very, very full of himself. He did go to the Vegan Academy and he learned all this stuff, but he actually doesn't know what it is to be a vegan. And again, we see he is dumb and dumb and dumb. And we see that he is very, very dumb. That's arguably the best thing that Brendan Routh has ever done. It's either that or Superman Returns. He had a little bit part as like a gay porn star, I think, in Zack and Mary Make a Porno. And I'm out of things that Brendan Routh did, and this is just the clear winner. I love how over the top so many of the other evil exes are, with, you know, some exceptions. Mae Whitman reuniting with Sarah from her Arrested Development days as Roxy something. I can't remember what her last name is. She is just bi furious, she says in the movie. It's stupid. It's just a play on words, but she invests those kind of line readings with so much fury and anger and passion. She's just so much fun. And the music by Beck and other artists is tremendously listenable. The score itself and the songs that Scott's band plays and other bands in the movie play, a lot of fun. Like, the surface appeal of this movie, I think, is deep. However, the theme, buried as it is under all this flash, it resonates. I think it works, but I just have such a hard time with Scott himself that it doesn't necessarily resonate as much as it might for some other people. Just the idea that a person can have all this uninterrogated shittiness towards their romantic partners without even realizing it, like Mediocre Movie Club fans will remember when we talked about Eighth Grade, that that was something we mentioned there, the scene in that movie where an older boy kind of corners the lead in Eighth Grade in the back of his car, and nothing happens, but it's still very traumatic for her. And like, she's going to remember that while he is going to go on and live the rest of his life. And that was something we discussed in that movie. It's just, it's almost certainly something that everybody has. Everyone's been cruel to someone, you know, who liked them and wasn't liked back, or was interested in and didn't reciprocate. And I certainly have that in my life. Just all of my Catholic ingrained repression reared its ugly head in college, where you just, you know, you have a fun night with a person and then you can't bring yourself to say another word to them afterwards because you've internalized all this shame. And that's my own problem, obviously, but it's still, it was unquestionably shitty, probably, for that other person as well. For the people that really love this movie, and there are a lot of them out there, even if I don't count myself as one, I would imagine that, because this is, again, Edgar Wright and Scott Pilgrim as well, just it is going to hook into people of a certain age, and those people of a certain age, you know, went through college during hookup culture, and all these hookup apps and dating apps and all that, and the idea that you would have this trail of evil exes following you throughout your life, unquestionably true for a lot of people. That theme, as potent as it might be, filtered through these characters, it's hard to really hook in. As far as the style of Scott Pilgrim, it's just too much for me. I would get rid of all of the Seinfeld stuff. I would get rid of a lot of this movie that is just, it's a question of like joke density. Like, well, if you didn't like that reference, it's okay. We'll make you forget about it by throwing another five at you in the next 30 seconds. And that kind of stuff is purposefully bludgeoning the viewer into submission. And that's how I felt here. Again, that Seinfeld bit, awful. Just truly terrible. It's just too much. It's just too much. I'm sure for some people, the amount of stylistic references and all of that is just enough. But no one would ever say that there's not enough. Like, there's too little little sprites and MIDI files and all kinds of other bullshit that are just icing on a cake that's not particularly good in the first place. The last thing to say about Scott Pilgrim is a familiar complaint about movies that resurfaces on the Mediocre Movie Club. The stakes from moment to moment, like, is Scott Pilgrim himself ever in any real danger of being exploded into coins? I feel like Lucas Lee, played by Chris Evans, tosses him, you know, 100 feet in the air through a castle, a prop castle, surely, but a castle nonetheless, and I don't understand why you wouldn't, I don't know, the rules of this made-up world are just flimsy, and the idea that Scott is this, like, martial artist extraordinaire, I don't know. This is overthinking it. This is not that serious of a complaint. It's just something that exists in the movie. I remember feeling that way when I first watched it, and I still feel that way now, curmudgeon though I may be. This is a C+ for me. I know that's on the grand scale of people that have seen Scott Pilgrim, which again has its capital P partisans. That's on the low end, but I appreciate good chunks of this movie, a lot of Sarah's performance, his commitment to this irritating sad sack that he plays. Yeah, it's hard to get on. It's hard to get fully on board with old Scott Pilgrim. Our next movie is 2018's Private Life. This is a movie that was released directly onto Netflix, directed by Tamara Jenkins, an indie darling who, as I said in my review, spent 11 years in the wilderness between her earlier movie, The Savages, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney, about a pair of siblings who are in like the end of life stage for their father. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I remember it being pretty well, and it was certainly well received. Private Life was also well received. It's another movie of a certain type about New York artistic types. And the main thrust of the movie is them trying to get pregnant and or adopt a kid. There, and it's Catherine Hahn as the wife, Rachel, and Paul Giamatti as Richard, the husband. And they have gone through several rounds of IVF. Nothing's taken. They're both in their 40s. Well, he's in his 50s. And it just tracks the various indignities and embarrassments and trials and tribulations of this whole process. This movie, I'm a big fan. To spoil my grade, it's a B+ for me, but I think the movie, and I would give Tamara Jenkins the benefit of the doubt here and say that this may very well be purposeful, but it never just straight up asks, what if we didn't have kids for Rachel and Richard? That's a question that kind of hangs over the movie, like, would it be so terrible if we gave up? And there are, at certain low points in the movie, the characters themselves express that reticence with continuing on this process and just wanting it to be over and wanting to get back to their normal life, which is in a bit of a stasis. You get the sense that they've like hit their creative peaks and are not necessarily going to be able to replicate those earlier successes, which weren't that significant in the first place. And perhaps having a child or adopting a child, whatever, is a way for them to reinvigorate their lives. But when those ideas are broached, they are treated as arguing points instead of like real possibilities. Because on the one hand, this movie is about them trying to have a baby, and sure, like if they decided just not to do it, then there is no movie. Scott Pilgrim just can't decide he doesn't want to date Ramona Flowers anymore. But that, as a childless person, and I may very well be an inadequate person to interrogate the real life equivalencies in private life. All the suffering, and it is suffering that they go through, both to trying to have a baby on their own, bring in the surrogate, to adopt. We see how all of those things fail, and just the pain of that. It really makes the viewer think, what if you just didn't do this? And I think, I want to give the movie the benefit of the doubt and pretend that that is purposeful. But it is kind of something that just hangs over it. They do try and rope in a niece who is not related by blood, thankfully. Her name is Sadie. I don't have the actress's name off the top of my head. She's something of a newcomer. She could have been a truly terrible and insufferable character. She is a failed art student. Although she wouldn't refer to herself as failed, she would say she has an incomplete ready to be completed at any moment. But she was in art school and she doesn't have a degree, so call it what you will. She very, I think, nimbly walks the line between someone who you could not stand to be a second around and someone who is knowledgeable that is very much a type that she gets very close to indulging in, but pulls herself back. She's pushing the envelope with Richard and Rachel, even though her love for them and their love for her is continuously apparent. Jenkins ends a lot of scenes in awkward silence after she's said something that he doesn't think is an insult, but could be read as one. Like, she calls them starving artists. They're not starving artists by any means, but starving artists implies that they're creating without any results or any, you know, any success, any income. And that's not true. She admires them for doing that, but given the choice between a starving artist and a, if not successful artist, then one who is paying the bills with their work, that's what they are. The idea of them being a starving artist just, you know, is inaccurate. I just really like this actress whose name I now see is Sadie Barrett. She showed up in Charlie Says, a movie from 2019. She played Squeaky Frome in that. It's about the Charlie Manson murders. And I think she's got a specific kind of career for her because she is a specific look. She's not necessarily an ingenue type, but she's, you know, put her in a Noah Baumbach movie and she'd fit right in. She could very well be the next Greta Gerwig. As far as back to private life, the bulk of it, Fertility clinics don't necessarily come in for, you know, flowers and rainbows here. It's obviously been hugely productive for a lot of people. A lot of people have been able to have a baby or multiple babies because of the work of fertility clinics. It sure looks through this prism as an overpriced scam, especially when there are so many babies to be adopted. Although at the same time, that seems very difficult as well through the lens of private life. I wish I could remember where I heard this just recently, but something in this vein, it may very well have been private life itself, but the idea that anybody gets pregnant is kind of miraculous based on the small window that it can happen in general, but that window is just ever smaller and smaller and smaller the older a woman and a man get. They're always, just because people keep having babies later and later and later for wholly justified reasons, financial, career, whatever, there's just going to be a place for these fertility clinics, and it seems like they can charge whatever they want for a process that is, you know, essentially a roll of the dice. Like, Richard and Rachel are compared by their cousin Molly Shannon, Sadie's mom, to compulsive gamblers. And that's a pretty apt comparison. The private life was very well received. I would be curious to hear from the standpoint of someone who just knows more about that. And I'm unclear if this is semi-autobiographical from Tamara Jenkins, who is probably of a similar age as Catherine Hahn, if not older. So this may very well be a personal document. It's very interesting. This is always, you know, a constant right-wing concern. Like, oh my gosh, the birth rate, the birth rate, the birth rate. Well, I don't know. Staff up adoption agencies, and maybe that isn't a problem. I somewhat wonder if it's a failure of the film that over the course of the movie we see that the procedure does not work. And the characters are obviously disappointed, not only for the loss of the effort, emotional and otherwise, that they put into having this process work, but as well as the sunk costs of all of the money. And they bring this up as well. We put so much money into this, it would be like it was all for nothing if nothing came of it. Classic sunk cost fallacy there. When it all comes up empty, I have no doubt the movie wants you to awe and furrow your brow and, like, when are Richard and Rachel going to pull one over on their old uterus or someone else's uterus? But I'm very much in Richard's in Richard's corner. Like, it would be good if everything went back to normal for this couple. And just all these fertility treatments and worrying and worrying and worrying has put such a strain on the marriage that even if they were successful, you kind of wonder, like, is this marriage long for the world anyways? And the movie kind of rhymes with an ending from another 2018 movie about a strained marriage. Tully, final scene in Tully is a husband and wife doing dishes together. They share earphones. It's an intimate moment. It signifies a closer connection between the two of them. And it's essentially the same thing in private life where they join each other on the side of a booth as they await a potential adoption candidate. And that went badly for them previously. Maybe this one will go better, but the movie leaves that hanging. Like, they're still trying at the end of this movie. To compare this to Scott Pilgrim in the broadest possible sense, this is another subgenre I can imagine people having a hard time hooking into. Not only the Arrested Development young adult with Scott Pilgrim, that again, I think as a person gets older, they just have less and less patience for that type. I wonder, too, if a person could potentially have a hard time seeing yet another movie about surviving artists, striving artists, not striving necessarily, but like artists that are paying the bills with their art, with their writing, with their literature, whatever, in New York, where this movie is set. That's, again, I mentioned Noah Baumbach. There are lots of movies about those kinds of people, and Private Life is yet another about the various trials and tribulations of this specific demographic. I generally have more patience with this. Like, I've made my peace with this. This is just what people are going to make movies about, especially if they come from these artist clans, artist families, artist communities. But I can totally imagine a person being like, oh, great, another couple of fine arts majors trying to figure out the next step of their lives and losing attention immediately. But that's Private Life. I enjoyed this movie. It gave me a lot to think about. Great performances by Catherine Hahn, who has taken like a surprising path with her career. Like you would think, based on her breakout performance in Step Brothers more than a decade ago, that she would have been like this queen of raunch, master comedian. And she goes to that well occasionally in stuff like Bad Moms, which, you know, not a great movie, but she's very funny in. But she's more gone like the Jill Soloway, slower key indie humor route. And this is more of that. She is very funny here, but Private Life gives her a lot of room to be dramatic and to sell those big actor moment blow-ups. And Paul Giamatti, I mean, there's been no one more stalwart over the last several decades than him. And it's just good. It's good to see him in movies instead of Billions, spending time in Billions. I mean, I'm glad he's getting paid, obviously, but I don't know. The more time he spends making a TV show that I don't watch, that I hear is like pulpy trash, soap opera-y, male soap opera type stuff, inferior Succession. I don't know. The more time he spends on that show, the less time he spends making movies like this. Or Win-Win, which is one of my favorite movies of the decade. Stay tuned for that. A lot of stuff to recommend here. And again, I wish it wasn't just me discussing this movie, but someone who maybe knew what they were talking about as far as fertility clinics go. The final movie from this last month at the Media Movie Club is Dolomite Is My Name, another Netflix movie directed by Craig Brewer, he of Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. And I want to say the Footloose remake? God, can that be right? This is a biopic of Rudy Ray Moore, the underground midnight movie artist, director, actor, whatever, who produced the titular Dolomite movies. Off blaxploitation, like riffs on blaxploitation while blaxploitation is going on. I've never seen any of these movies. They're recognizable through Dolomite as the previously mentioned midnight movies, where, you know, a bunch of people would go and see them on some repertory theater and they would have a great time, you know, rolling in the aisles together as they laugh at the chintzy production details and the general earnestness of the production. This guy is essentially Tyler Perry before Tyler Perry was Tyler Perry. He's, and not necessarily just because they're both black, but because they're making movies, they're making the exact kind of movies that they believe their audience wants. And based on their success, they are correct. It's just, they're just not the kind of movies that, like, critics just don't go for Tyler Perry movies. Even, I want to say black critics. They're just inured to, not narrow, because I conform to the same band of quality, but like there's a specific idea of what a good movie is, and it's hard for someone like Tyler Perry to continue to make movies that he's known for and fit into that band. It just doesn't work there. It's positive and negative poles, and Rudy Ray Moore very much seems to be in that wheelhouse. We meet him as a hacky comic with bad material. He is clinging on to some MC gigs at a nightclub, and he has big dreams for himself. He wonders why, despite all of the striving. He's played by Eddie Murphy, and the character is likely in his mid-40s, early 50s, has had minimal success. Works at a record store, and the movie tracks his creation of this Dolomite persona and the creation of his first movie and the success thereafter. This is, again, another type, the middle-aged reinventor of their own lives. They're going to decide, you know, what they want to do and how they're going to do it, and they're going to demand that the public conform around them. There's a question, I think, in Dolomite Is My Name, of how much sympathy one has for Rudy Ray Moore, honestly, and this is another C-plus movie for me. This is where I came up short in this movie, where he was whiny. Because he continues to complain and complain and complain even after he has a lot of success as the Dolomite character. Like, he first cheers and applause leads to record sales, leads to national tours, and like not a lot of people don't have a national tour, so not enough for him. He insists on becoming a movie star as well, and does so. So it's he doesn't experience a lot of disappointment over the course of the film. He experienced a lot in the unseen period before the film begins, and for him to just somewhat continuously be wondering when he's really going to make it as he continues to make it throughout the course of the movie is kind of tiresome. You compare that to the character of Lady Reed, who finds herself in a similar position as Rudy Ray Moore, where she believes herself to be a talented individual. The viewer sees that she is in the same way that we see that Rudy Ray Moore is, but just the stakes of her life are more compelling, higher. She has a child who she, you know, is trying to raise, and she seems to start from a lower place. So to see her succeed in conjunction with Moore, I'm always more invested in her than I am with him. And I think, you know, Eddie Murphy is the star, he's the lead. The movie's going to focus on him, sure, but I always just want to know what Lady Reed is up to. How is she doing? How is she going to parlay this moment into broader success for her and for her child? That actress, Sadie from Private Life, is also someone I am previously unfamiliar with. Her name is Divine Joy Randolph, and she just immediately pulls focus the second she's introduced in Dolomite Is My Name, and she could very well have been the co-lead of this movie in as far as audience investment and wanting just as good of things, if not better, for her as I do for Moore. She kind of steals the movie from Eddie Murphy, even though this movie is being treated as a resurrection vehicle. Yet again, yet one more resurrection vehicle for a guy who's had many of them. But Eddie Murphy is like riding this towards a reintroduction into the spotlight, and I hope that Divine Joy Randolph is able to follow him there, if not take up her own spotlight. This movie is broken up into acts of wallowing self-pity on Moore's fault at first, then breaking out as the Dolomite character, then making the movie, and then the aftermath of making the movie. Is it going to succeed? Is it going to fail? It does succeed. I feel like I say this all the time. I'm not a real critic. I'm an amateur critic who's talking to himself in an upstairs bedroom with my buddy. But I understand that the movie that is what you're watching, not the movie that you want. The movie that you want and critiquing from that is, you know, not necessarily good criticism. But I very much wanted this movie to be The Disaster Artist. I wanted the bulk of it to be about the making of the movie. I feel like directors, like that's catnip to them, the idea of making a movie about making movies. They have supreme confidence and knowledge with what it takes to make a movie, the many things that can go wrong on a multi-million dollar production, much less a production that, you know, is in the five figures instead of the eight or nine or ten figures. Not ten figures, that's insane. But the movie really kind of, like, that is unquestionably a chunk of Dolomite Is My Name, but it's just a smaller chunk than I would have liked. It was over too quick, I thought. It didn't go in deep enough. There was an opportunity for some competence porn, for some procedure, which is, you know, those always tickle my movie-watching bones. Those problems just kind of solve themselves in the movie. All of my questions about Dolomite Is My Name, all my concerns about Dolomite Is My Name, kind of center around the movie-making part. Of course, it's one thing to leave the viewer wanting more. It's another thing to leave them wanting only that. I only wanted more movie making. I wanted more Lady Reed. I wanted more movie making. Dolomite Is My Name. Cody Smith McPhee, a young actor who has made fantastic choices over the course of his career. He was in, he was introduced in The Road. He was in Let Me In, the American adaptation of Let the Right One In, which frankly I prefer, an unpopular opinion. He's been in a lot of great movies. He's been stuck in... Not stuck. Well, yes, stuck. He joined the X-Men franchise a little too late. Those first two movies are pretty good. The last two, not good. The ones that he's in, that he plays a small role in. He plays Nightcrawler. But I kind of feel like, based on his appearance in Dolomite Is My Name, people should be worried about him. When he first shows up as a student cinematographer that Rudy recruits to shoot his movie Dolomite, you're waiting for character to, you know, walk into a back room of the set that they're shooting in and see him with a needle in his arm, he looks like he is 90 pounds and he's in his early 20s. The fact that they didn't comment on this during the movie implies that this is just how Cody Smith McPhee looks. I'm really concerned for this kid because he's, again, a great actor, burgeoning career, makes fantastic choices. He may very well starve in the next month or so. I'm just concerned. Wesley Snipes plays a major role in this movie as the director, as a real actor in this world. He is brought in to direct. I kind of think the movie is too mean to him. Maybe this is an adherence to the real person's demeanor on set, but he's first of all, Wesley Snipes is doing a very strange accent, very strange affect, a lot going on with his character, a lot of choices being made by Wesley Snipes. Great to see him back on screen, but he's taken some big swings in Dolomite Is My Name. I kind of assumed that he would become something of a mentor to Rudy Ray Moore. Not the case. They are constantly standoffish. I don't know. That felt like a missed opportunity. This movie is clearly going for like a feel-good vibe. And just, again, the production of a movie is like all these people pulling together to make something that they're passionate about. And Snipes' director character, it's unclear what he's even doing on set, first of all. But second of all, he's never invested. He never bridges that gap. And I don't know. I feel like that was a blown opportunity for just more of that feel-good aspect. And instead, as he leaves the set brusquely and insultingly after the last shot, I think that's just in there to make the audience think that this movie's going to fail. Whereas, like, if everybody was clapping themselves on the back and happy with how it went, it would somewhat rob the final act of tension. But that same tension is, you know, they do the same thing twice. Is this movie going to succeed? Moore's put all of his money up. And if he doesn't, the record company owns him forever. Not only is the first theater that he shows Dolomite in packed and full and raucous and exactly what he wanted, so is the second one. So, like, I don't know, how many times can you pull that rug out from under the viewer, the expectations? It's a fun movie. What is there with the movie-making part, which, again, I felt was the best and had the most potential? It is still tremendously watchable, and Murphy is very, he's very charismatic, despite, again, something of the whininess of the character. I think the movie takes way too charitable a view towards him. As I said in my review, he wholesale steals the Dolomite character from local homeless people that he's ostensibly friends with. He knows their names. They greet him every day. He's kind to them in the record store, but there's no sense of him like helping them out after they make him rich and famous. They give him the idea of Dolomite, and he, as a comic, you would think that would be not okay, something of a taboo. And then he's allowed to film the movie in a set that has become something of a flop house. He is allowed to use the set for free by throwing them out. And then I think the movie tellingly doesn't show this character who's supposed to love, you know, tossing out addicts and homeless people out of this place, because that would make us not like him. He used to be down and out, and here he is, you know, pulling the ladder up after himself, after he's made it, and now he's treating people that... He was never homeless necessarily, but he was maybe a few rungs above them on the economic hierarchy. And again, here he is off camera throwing them out of a place that they've been able to find shelter in. So Brewer and Murphy both, they just put their hands clearly on the scale, and it's pretty see-through. But again, Divine Joy Randolph is a true find. Murphy is still charismatic. It's easy to see why this movie should have been made, why Moore is an important figure, both in hip hop, as he is referred to in the end crawl as the godfather of rap, the cadence that he brought to Dolomite the character, and as someone who made these crowd pleasing midnight movies. Great, make the movie about him, but I just wish the movie about him was a little better. That'll do us for this episode of the Munich Movie Club podcast. At this very moment, if you go to our Facebook page at Munich Movie Club, you'll be able to vote in our ongoing end of the decade 64 movie tournament. Obviously, this isn't going to be released on the day I'm recording it, but we're only on day two. There are many more games, many more matchups to get through. I think the main question of this tournament is we have some Mad Max Fury Road haters, which relegated that movie, arguably one of the best movies of the decade, to a low seed. So is like a 12 seed or whatever it actually is. It might be 13, it might be 14. Is that going to take, you know, the tournament? We'll see. We've already lost Logan, which won our previous, that won our previous Mediocre Madness that we do every March. So it's a lot of fun. Who knows? We'll see what happens. Our next trio, we've got some heavy hitters in there as well. We'll be talking about Noah Baumbach. This guy's coming up all the time. Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story. And we'll be talking about Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. And we'll be talking about Under the Radar 2019 release Under the Silver Lake. Those first two are available on Netflix. And that last one is available on Amazon Prime. There'll be a lot to discuss there. The Irishman in particular is a 3.5-hour movie that is larded up with content that we'll be back here to discuss and tear apart and get into in the coming weeks. Again, as previously mentioned, stay tuned for more Watchmen talk. There's a lot going on in that show that we can plumb the depths of and probably not get anywhere close to where they really are. A lot going on in Watchmen. But in the meantime, you can read the reviews of the movies that we just talked about and many more at MunichMovie.club. Follow us on Twitter at MunichMovieCle. And if you're doing some holiday shopping, if you were to go to our page and click on the Amazon link and shop as normal, that gets us our sole source of income, essentially. We get a few percent off of that purchase at no cost to you. So thank you for joining me tonight, listeners, and we'll talk again here soon.